Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, joined today by Michael Morris. We've been having a little bit of sound issues from Michael's end, but hopefully those are mostly dealt with now, and we shall continue on with the show as planned. So our first story for today is the news that the SAA Takatso deal is off. A group called the Takatso Consortium was planning to buy a 51% share in South African Airways. And this was also going to come along with a 3 billion rand cash injection, which would rescue the airline from collapse. SAA has been in financial trouble since a long time, as far as I can remember, at least since 2010 or so. It's received multiple government bailouts, and it's become a real drain on the fiscus without providing much in the way of kind of easily identifiable benefits. Well, there was a secret briefing hidden from the media in Parliament by Public Enterprises Minister Pravin Gordhan just recently, where he was updating Parliament on the Takatso deal, the Takatso consortium deal. That was all very mysterious. Shortly after that, he announced that he was resigning after the next local government elections in May. Sorry, the next national government elections in May. Now the news has been made public by Gordhan that the deal is in fact off. Gordhan says the deal is off because the assets of SAA are now more valuable than they were in 2021 during COVID when the original deal was negotiated. And in the interest of protecting the public's interests in finances, they couldn't sell it at such a low price. Now, considering the fact that SAA is losing money and that SAA has been losing money for a very long time and causing this huge drain on the fiscus, this argument doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Michael, what do you make of this?
The various things sort of struck me looking at the story and how it's been covered in various places, and one of the striking ones comes right at the end of the Daily Maverick version, where they speak to analyst Peter Attard Montalto, and his kind of brisk comment seems to sum it up. He said, given that Takatso never had the money, could never have agreed to a higher valuation, and had no aviation partner, the deal was always going to fail right from the beginning. So just right from the start, one has a sense, and this is reminiscent actually also of the efforts to bring the private sector into the transport sector with Transnet and railways, is that, you know, one's first sort of sense, and I don't know enough about business to really analyze this from an economic point of view, from a business point of view, but just the sense of it is that we need a much more serious-minded approach to anything that involves drawing the private sector into this highly tricky, huge, very costly infrastructure environment that the government is trying to do. They're trying to get help. They've clearly kind of run out of ideas. They've run out of running out of money. The prospect of more and more bailouts is horrifying. It was particularly leading up to an election. They don't want to have to admit all these things. But the private sector really would have a more serious-minded way of dealing with the problems. And quite likely be able to draw on resources that the government simply doesn't have, but certainly draw on the expertise. But for that to happen, for that to work, the government itself has got to be much more open to, I would think, just looking at it from as a lay outsider, open approach to simply exploiting that expertise, exploiting the willingness of partners to come in, and understanding that they're only going to do it if they're going to make money out of it. It's not altruism and charity. They've got to be businesslike about it, and without knowing any of the technicalities and any of the details, that is simply my sense of this one. The other thing that happens to come from the very top of the same story in the Daily Maverick is the writers mentioned in the or writing in the introduction to his piece that this the collapse of the Jakarta deal delivers a massive blow to Cyril Ramaphosa's reform agenda. And, you know, the immediate thought that comes to mind, as we were saying before we started the show, is that, you know, it's as if what most concerns the government is getting rid of the jobs that it's meant to do and getting the private sector to take them on. And that if it can't actually shed these responsibilities and pass them on to people who can do it, this is really what the crisis is. And we, of course, know differently. It's a question of creating the policy environment in which all these things happen, and it's something that is certainly within the purview of the government. It doesn't actually have to hand everything over, although in the short term it would certainly need the kind of assistance, the kind of expertise the private sector does have to get things done as quickly as possible. But yeah, these are both, I think, two telling sort of indicators of exactly how the government is approaching the work it's meant to do and the work it is hoping others are going to help it to achieve. There was a phrase you used, I must remind you, in the run-up to the start of the show, where we were talking about the impulse of the government being often to simply defer the issue, put it off for, you know, this deal is now cancelled, but we're going to put it off, maybe pump a bit more money into it. And the phrase you used was, what they really want to do is just survive for the next 5 minutes. And I think this is it's a chronic sort of pathology that we now live with, and we live with the consequences of, which we see playing out right across this kind of government activity in key sectors like transport, energy, and services generally. And it's simply not enough. The economy can't survive on that basis.
Exactly. It's also been speculated that something about the collapse of this deal is also related to why Gordhan has announced his retirement from politics at this particular time. It's difficult to say that for sure, but if there is indeed something along those lines, I'm sure it will become increasingly apparent recently. But the timing here is very suspicious, considering that the deal collapsed just before he announced his resignation, which is not a thing that ANC ministers actually do publicly that often, even when they're quite old. He also says that the SAA will have money to go on for about another year without having to go into total collapse or shutdown. That's not super comforting, and also that's when it will no longer be his problem. One wonders whether this is the real reason why he is resigning in some way as a public enterprises minister. Okay. Let us move on to our next story. And this is one of those stories which is not super big, but kind of speaks to a lot of issues. So in Randburg in Johannesburg, there was a house recently that caught fire. And there were several problems during the fire. One was that I believe I'm correct in saying that the local municipal fire service could not be contacted because they didn't have radios or phones or that worked at their station. So a local private security company which runs a fire service as well, with some help from our neighbors and other sort of companies in the area, actually put out the fire. But what's interesting is what was going on in the house. So apparently this house was being run by a guy who used to work as the gardener at the premises. He had worked for the family who owned the house for a long time. The old people at the house died, and the children were apparently drug addicts who just disappeared and were no longer there to look after the house. As a result, the gardener seems to have basically decided that, well, no one else is using it, I might as well. And he started renting it out on an enormous scale, despite being, it sounds like a fairly typical, normal suburban household, maybe, you know, 3 or 4 bedrooms. He rented it out to about 100 people, who he was charging each 400 rand a month to stay there. There were something like 30 people reported to have been living in the garage alone. So packed very tightly in there and in the outside cottage, apparently there were even some people sleeping outside under trees. The property had no water or electricity, and I suspect that rates or taxes hadn't been paid on it for a long time. It was essentially dilapidated. The gardener reportedly told his tenants that part of the reason he was charging them 400 rand was because he needed to pay bribes to the police in order for them to turn a blind eye to the problems on the property and the fact that this was clearly illegal. He also let a mechanic sort of set up in the backyard. And apparently this is how the fire started. The caretaker was showing a new tenant around the place, and he threw his lit cigarette onto some motor oil, which was next to some tires, part of where this mechanic was working, and that caught fire to the house. As far as I know, no one was hurt or killed or anything like that, so that's very good. But this kind of speaks to so many issues about the failure of local governance and its ability to kind of police bylaws, the poverty and desperation of so many people that, you know, people willing to pay 400 rand a month to go and sleep basically under a tree in someone's garden, or, you know, stacked inside a car garage, you know, with 29 other people. But also, I think it says something about property rights. You know, this property basically fell into no one's real usage. And in that space, when the you know, sort of control of the property was not vested in anyone, no one had a truly vested interest in it. The guy who was running the place, he didn't have real tenure over it. He didn't have any kind of real legal right to it. And so he just thought to himself, it seems I'm just going to run this as long as it goes. And, well, we found out how long it goes. It goes until you accidentally burn it down. But Michael, what do you make of this story?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it does, it's very much one of those instances where one can rightly say this is a microcosm of our society in various very, very interesting ways, actually. I remember a phrase that I don't know if one hears it all that much these days, or as much as one used to, but a Buddha Mike a plun. And that's true, I think, for all people, you know, all people, certainly in this society like ours, where there's a great pressure on people to make a plan because nobody else is doing it for you. And we see it here just very superficially in two instances. The fire service that comes is not the state's fire service or the municipal fire service. It's the one that people have got together and made a plan to fund, and that's what you rely on. And then you have the caretaker, who's in fact turns out actually the gardener of the property, as you say, no rights at all, no responsibility either, but maybe an opportunity. And on the other hand, also these hordes of people, quite a number of them, just looking at the story, who, you know, kind of productive members of society. One was a hawker. I'm just kind of glancing at the story that I happened to notice that. I mean, they're clearly people who are earning some kind of income to pay their 300 to 400 rand a month rental to the caretaker, but this speaks also to you know, a huge urbanization, massive urbanization pressures on our society and on our cities, and you're mentioning property rights. I think is absolutely crucial for various reasons, but we're just to consider one, the ANC, the ruling party's sort of emphasis on this and the emphasis that is placed on it by so many people in society, very often people who are in the middle class and who own property themselves, but people overlook that because they want to be part of this, the kind of left debate about land reform and so on. All the focus just about is on this agrarian romanticism of people living on farms, living in the countryside, and getting their stake of South African land, you know, out in the Karoo or in the rural areas, whereas in fact the crisis that is now being ignored very largely, or which requires much, much more serious and considered attention, is precisely in the cities. And here we have one house with 100 people. I wouldn't say comfortably living there. They've chosen to. It's an option for them. It's a real option for them to have a place in the city. They're living there. They're paying for it. And in the absence of property rights, everybody is actually vulnerable there. It's a fantastic illustration of exactly what the kind of pressures are on the city. You've got a city with failing infrastructure and with enormous needs and a very great demand for the presence actually of authorities. Often the presence of authorities is unwelcome, but there are instances where we need an effective state, and this is one of them. So, yeah, a very interesting story, I think.
Definitely. Also, of course, police corruption being a problem here, and that this guy was, well, we don't actually know, because we don't know whether he was paying the bribes or whether that was just an excuse to his tenants. But I suspect that probably was a factor here, that he was having to pay off someone to look the other way. because dilapidated properties by this usually do get picked up by the municipality at some point. And this has been going on for, I think, at least five years or longer. Okay, let's move on to our last story. And this is just some comments made by former President Thabo Mbeki. He has been attacking Jacob Zuma, the other former president, accusing him of pretty much intentionally undermining democracy. Specifically, he talks about how under Zuma's control, the South African Revenue Service, SARS, was massively weakened and corrupted and began to no longer collect the large revenues that it used to. And Mbeki suggests that this was part of a deliberate effort to sabotage South Africa's democratic state. He said, these people, those who destroyed SARS, were people who are hostile to the democratic state and don't want it to succeed. If you take away these revenues, it won't be possible for the state to succeed. Those are people who didn't like our democracy and wanted something else. What do you make of these comments, Michael?
I've kind of mixed feelings in a way. I mean, I think Mbeki was definitely a finer chap than Jacob Zuma turned out to be. But there's this kind of naivety in a sense in that, any polity that's investing so much power and capacity in the state is inevitably going to be contributing to undermining a democratic project. That's just how it is. He wasn't a Zuma by any manner of means, but his administration contributed also to passing legislation which invested increasing sums and quotients of power in the hands of the state, which ultimately enabled precisely the kind of activity that Zuma engaged in. Here is a funny thing. It's been a theme of Thabo Mbeki's comments recently, where he's spoken about the risk of the state being undermined to the extent that it doesn't function or can't function properly. And I'm kind of torn there. I think the private sector has a huge role to play and partnerships are very important, but I don't think the private sector can, in fact, ever really take over the function of an effective state. And we saw that in the previous story. We want, we want certain things to be functioning effectively. And for that, you need to have a solid sort of kind of functioning central state. But on the other hand, we see the power of nefarious players in the system, and that's exactly what was made visible with Zuma's activity in SARS.
Definitely. Yeah. Okay, we've gone a bit long today, so please forgive us for that. But anyway, I hope that you found the show interesting, and we will see you tomorrow with the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone. Have a great one.